Our next speaker is Matt Sanford. And when I thought about this program and how to put this together, I really wanted to get somebody to talk about what it means to move and how important it is to move on a personal level. And initially, I thought about an athlete. And in all of the athletes that I know, and most of my friends know, we couldn't actually come up with someone who we thought could express the kinds of things that we were looking for. And so another friend of mine, who unfortunately could not be here today, suggested Matt Sanford. Matt, as you can see, is a paraplegic, but he also teaches yoga in Minneapolis. And his approach to yoga and his approach to movement and his thoughts about movement, I think, will add quite a bit to our understanding of who and what we are and what we do. So if we could all please welcome Matt Sanford.
It's an honor to be here. You know, I met about five or six of you last night, and you guys seem really cool, which actually makes I spend a lot of time with other types of healthcare professionals, and you guys seem a little more open, which is good. I want to take a time to thank you for serving others, right off the bat, for caring for others, for serving others. That's a big deal. It's the most noble force on the planet, is to be of service. And the other thing I want to really thank you for, and I'm grateful for, is that you're willing to explore the relationship between the science of healing and the art of healing. That you're open to exploration, different ways of doing things. And I know each of you has your emphasis one way or the other towards science or towards the art of it. But I'm telling you as a patient, I'm here right now today as a patient and as someone who trains healthcare professionals, especially those experiencing compassion fatigue. I'm also here as a 13-year-old boy who survived a devastating car accident and broke a lot of bones. And I'm here as the person who's also a non-traditional healer that actually tries to help people heal in unexpected ways. I know that there's a feeling that it has to all be science, grounded in science, but at the end of the day, one of the things, I'm going to tell you a story today, my story to some extent, but it's about the mind-body relationship, and it's your story too. I'm telling a story about both your and my mind-body relationship, and that I truly and profoundly believe, after being a patient for as much and as long as I have, over 37 years, that the frontier of an evolving healthcare system, of medicine, of all of it, is actually the dynamic that exists between you and me. That's the best delivery system of what you carry in your head, what actually comes through your body. That it's the actual dynamic. Because I was at the Mayo Clinic International Symposium for healthcare, improving healthcare, and I was listening all day. Before I spoke, they gave me like 20 minutes, and all day I kept hearing about why patients aren't complying to treatment plans and adherence and all these things. And I got up and just said, you know what, as soon as you talk like that, your delivery system has failed. I don't care what you carry. At the end of the day, you've got to teach me to fish. You don't get to fix me. And this is a profound issue that I think is, we have a system right now that's creating dependent patients. You're living with the expectation on one level of having to fix me. That's the pressure you're getting on all levels. And simultaneously, you're working in a system that's giving you less and less time. That's making you have to enter more and more into a computer. Like, you are literally losing contact with the very thing that brought your heart into this work. This is a big problem. So I come here also today to tell you a story, but I know in this room that you're giving more than you're receiving. I know you're giving too much of yourself away. I'm watching it all over the country, right? And I'm worried about that. And I'm not just worried about it because I care about you, but I do care about you. But I'm also worried about it because if you don't recognize, if we don't recognize that the caregiver's outcome directly impacts the patient's outcome, we've got a problem. I've been doing this a long time and watching a long time. And that's something, so I'm going to talk to you about a mind-body approach as a way of thinking a little more holistically about these types of issues. But I want you to know that any kind of integrative approach, any kind of exploration into healing must include the caregiver and not just your head. Because at the end of the day, and what I like about being here at a conference like this, you guys, I'm also really, really grateful that you're not afraid of bodies. I'm telling you, I get exams sometimes without ever being touched. This is like, honestly, all this knowledge and all this diagnostic awareness is actually manifesting as a disconnect between our bodies. What's going on? Like, I wake up in the morning and at night sometimes going like, what? What's going on? How could this be true? Well, for really good reasons. But the other thing you got to know about what's going to happen for the next, 45 minutes or so is that I'm a yoga teacher. So I reserve the right to teach a yoga pose at any time. At any time. And so now we're going to start shifting a little bit more into my story a little bit. But I want you to do something kind of radical, and you're probably not used to doing this. I want you to take off your shoes. Me too. Now, some of you aren't going to do it, but I kind of think you should. Because I want to give a little defensive feat, right? You got to let the dogs bark, man. What do you do at the end of your day, after a long day? What's one of the first things you do when you get home? Why do you think you take off your shoes? It's freeing. It actually is the sensation of freedom. So take off your shoes, for God's sakes. Now, and usually a room full of, like, not osteopaths won't do this, and then you go into business, I teach speaking corporations, and they won't take off their shoes. And then if I really want to push you guys a little bit too far, I would ask you to take off your socks. But that'd be too much for most of you, because we don't share our bodies, especially in public. Right? And it's really interesting that you guys are on your feet all day long. And what do you do for your feet? You know, and I want to give a defensive feat. It turns out that feet end up being a lightning rod for a lot of our distaste with the body. This happens at all ages. And again, let me give you a little defensive feat just for a second. If you were at a dark, sweaty place 16 hours a day, how do you think you'd fare? Right? You'd smell, you'd develop toe jam, all those things. Is part of what you need to do with me is help me be more comfortable with my body? To actually start listening a little bit to my body more? Because unless you can get me to engage with the manipulations that you're doing, unless you can get me to feel and not just understand with my head, but to be part of the magic that's coming through your hands, not just knowledge. I call it magic because I don't know what else to call it. Right? If I'm not part of it, the most important part of the delivery of your awareness is shut down. So this is like, how are you going to help me be comfortable with my body? And yet, I'm probably coming to you with a lot of pain or an issue or whatever it is, and I'm not comfortable in my body. And yet, if you're trying to teach me to fish, as opposed to just fix me, being comfortable with my body is maybe the most important, essential thing you can show me. The other thing I'm worried about, as you guys are constantly giving away too much in a system that's disconnecting you from your patient, is that are you practicing such things as learning to sit in the presence of suffering without trying to fix it? Do you guys practice that? What do you do? And I want to tell you, one of the things I want to get across to you is that's a mind-body realization. You can't solve that problem mentally. Part part of being able to sit in the presence of suffering without trying to fix it, even though everyone's telling you you have to fix everything, and yet you know you can't all the way. So you're literally engaged in a paradox all day long. They're telling you it's a psychological issue or a boundary issue, and it's way deeper than that. How about you guys practice how to give and receive simultaneously? Do you practice that as a sensation? How do you do it? These are the best practices you guys need to be sharing, too. I get all the physics and the engineering part of it. I know that's important. And for a lot of you, that's a door opener, right? But don't forget the patient. Don't forget that I actually am not as interested in what you know. I'm interested in humanity and getting better. Healing is a human art. It's more than just what you know in your head. And that's a really important thing. So let me tell you a little bit about my story. I was in a car accident when I was 13, so it was 1978, 37 years ago. It was an overcast day and misting, and seemed harmless, 32 degrees. And we're driving home to Kansas City, Missouri, and my whole family was in the car on the Sunday after Thanksgiving, and we hit preferential icing going over a bridge. And went tumbling down the embankment. My father and sister were killed. My mother and brother didn't sustain any physical injuries, but I went through a shredder. I broke my neck at C1. I broke my back at T456. I broke both my wrists. I filled a lung with fluid, and I sustained an injury to my pancreas that left me unable to eat for nearly 60 days. It just completely shut down. So I went from 119-pound, very athletic boy to 79 pounds in less than 60 days. Because back in 1978, I didn't have nutrients to feed through the neck. I was in a coma for 3.5 days, so I literally went to sleep next to my sister and woke up 3.5 days later to a completely changed world. That's the backdrop and the beginning of waking. I wrote a memoir about this. I'm going to read a little bit from it in a second. So there's a lot going on, and I'm not aware of it, but apparently after the first day I wake up, the nurses are turning me from side to side, and I'm passing out very quickly. It's from a lot of pain, but something is really not right. And the nurses can feel that it's not right, that the turning's too dangerous. And they go to the doctors. The doctors had chosen to put a soft collar brace on my neck. And that was it. And they weren't the ones rolling me. So the nurses, as they're rolling me, are knowing something's not okay here. And they try to tell the doctors. They try to say, we got it. Something's not right here. And the doctors just kind of shut them down. And so these nurses, one of them in particular, takes my mom aside. And she says, Paula, you've got to get Matt out of here. If he were my son, I'd get him to the Mayo Clinic. But there are so many things going on here. And I've talked to other nurses, and we're not sure about what's going on here. And I'm trying to imagine being my mom in that moment. You've lost your husband. You've lost your firstborn. Your baby is hanging in the balance, and all of a sudden there's a separation based on a deep, overriding concern about the survival of her boy. So my mom is like, wow, and she goes to the neurologist the next day and asks, why aren't we doing more for Matthew? And this doctor, 1978, he's coming to the very end of his career. And, you know, in 1978, there hadn't been that many great outcomes for spinal cord injuries, really. Things really changed after the Vietnam War. A lot of people started surviving spinal cord injuries, then our culture started to shift and make things better for them. And so he said, Paula, we don't know if Matt's even going to make it to the next day. Right? And his injuries, they're all over the place. There's a lot of things going wrong. And he said, you know, but you don't even realize that Matt's life is never going to be the same. This injury is radical. And it's going to be a really hard life. And Paula, sometimes it's better just to let your loved ones go. Mama Tiger comes out. Strongest force in the universe, right? She says, I don't think so, actually. Yeah. My dad was a lawyer, and so she calls my dad's law partner and says, Bruce, she asks him, well, I want to take him to Mayo Clinic, and the doctor says, I can't sign a release. He's going to not make the trip. So my mom's got it in her head, he's not going to make it otherwise, right? And so she calls my dad's law partner and says, Bruce, I can't get him out of here. And my Bruce drives down and goes right up to the neurologist and says, we won't sue you if you sign this release right here. I'm to the next place. So after a five-hour drive on a mobile home ICU, pardon me, I get to the Mayo Clinic, and I'm going to read you a scene. It's a traumatic scene that I first encounter when I get off the mobile home ICU and I get into the Mayo Clinic. Aggressive treatment is what we wanted. Aggressive treatment is what we got. I met by a team of doctors and brought into an open area. There's no time lapse. There's only action. A curtain is drawn, and suddenly I'm enclosed in an artificial room. I suspect that this is an emergency room, but there's no telling. The view is not great from flat on my back. The lights overhead are bright and hot, yet my vision is dim. The faces and voices are like shadows, conversation swirling, no apparent direction. I'm surrounded by many bodies. Two men are standing particularly close by each of my shoulders. They whisper to each other right over my chest. The quality of their voices reveals their importance, crisp, authoritative, calm with a confident edge. But they have no faces. I see only arms, hands, torsos, and the undersides of their chins. They're holding some sort of hand tools. Unknown to me, I'm about to have four metal screws twisted directly into my skull. It is the first step in getting a halo cast, the ultimate in neck stabilization. Suddenly, two other men appear from above me and hold down my arms. Two screwdrivers move toward my temples. My skin breaks. Warmness runs into my hair. The pain is sharp and getting sharper. A horrible sound explodes in my head, not from the outside in, but from the inside out. The screws continue to twist into my skull. The pressure is slow at first, building, and then exponential. My head no longer exists in three dimensions. No space between collapsing sides. Just two rocks grinding each other. Suddenly, it's done. Assemblage of vision returns. Then out of nowhere, it begins again, twisting right above each ear. This time, I'm not in that body. There is no subject to that experience. I land in profound silence watching a boy. He is on a table. A sheet is drooped loosely over his lower body. He seems so small. Time is off track, and I am everywhere. The doctors move, but things are held up, stretched out, turned over, pulled apart, a silent movie on a faltering projector. Suddenly, time finds its rhythm. Sounds appear again. The vacuum is broken. A timid voice I recognize as my own. Somebody help me. Path of realization, big or small, almost always starts bumpy. In my case, I was thrown off a cliff. In retrospect, I realized that this halo experience altered the course of my life. It left me with an insight. At a moment of intense physical pain, the fragile state of my living was able to move away from my body. The potential for dislocation between mind and body was dramatically revealed. The insight, however, was not the ability to disassociate. It was the silence that I experienced while it happened. This silence not only allowed me to separate from my body, but it was also sticky enough to maintain a life-preserving connection. Somehow, I stayed connected to that boy below me. The silence within my consciousness both separates me and connects me simultaneously. This paradoxical insight still guides my life. The silence within my consciousness both separates me and connects me simultaneously. Clearly, that's not just true for me. I'm ailing. I'm your patient. I'm afraid. I'm getting disconnected. The distance between you and me grows because this part of my mind-body relationship recedes. I use it as a buffer. I'm afraid to come forward, come through space and meet you. So things do like matter, certain things like if you're kind to me, if you actually listen. But it's not just something, it's not just a moral issue, you listening to me as a patient. It's a dynamic issue. You're trying to open the connection, the part of my mind-body relationship that will be key to my recovery, to my resilience, to my strength. The subtle part of my mind-body relationship is what's going to drive my long-term outcome. Here's the wonderful thing. The subtle part of your mind-body relationship is going to be essential to your long-term outcome. If we can meet there, in little glimpses, your outcome and my outcome is going to improve. The question is, are we going to be open enough in order for that to occur? In order for the greatest binding force of us, our humanity, to actually be part of the interaction without it being a moral issue, without it being about you just being more patient-centered. Because isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful what they're doing to you right now? You guys are up to your frickin' gills with things to do, with constraints and all those things. And then they're telling you on top of it, hey, by the way, could you just be more patient-centered? Really? The paradox of patient-centered care is that the caregiver has to become more aware of themselves. That's where we're at now. You guys can't give one more thing away. Can't do it. I've watched it. I see it. If you do, it's not sustainable. But again, we're talking about a part of human being that our culture tends to think of as psychological, as spiritual. I want to talk about it in terms of the mind-body relationship. I want to talk about it as a sensation. That's why I'm going to start telling you more of my story. That this isn't just about good bedside manner. This is about the human dynamic coming together and helping healing facilitate. That's what it's about. But it means you have to be more open too. There's a reason why I'm talking at a conference for osteopaths as opposed to a talk to a conference of orthopedic surgeons, right? Take that in all the way. I like you guys a lot better. Just so you know. And yet, when I need a good, if I need a good surgery, I hope I get a good one. And he crushes my bones and saws them up and does a whole bunch of stuff that I've been awake for, by the way. I've seen a whole bunch of weird things I would rather not have ever seen. Right? But I get it. But that's not who I'm with right now because I don't think they have the sensibilities. I think they're afraid of bodies. That's what I think. They don't see them as living all the way. But they have to. They have to have a lot of confidence. They got a knife and they're cutting me open. I want them to be confident. Right? Arrogant, I guess, is okay too. It helps them, I guess. Whatever. Right? I digress. But getting back to that out-of-body experience, you guys, that the relationship between mind and body is in constant flux. And it's not a big deal. So that's the most extreme out-of-body experience I've ever had, right? And I've never had anything like that again. I've had versions of it. But it's not about the extremity of it. It's about recognizing how ordinary that is, right? So think about that time you're driving 70 miles an hour down the interstate, and suddenly you startle because you haven't noticed the landscape for 20 minutes. You know that feeling? Like, oh, my God, where have I just been? Where do you think you went? Seriously. How about that time when someone's talking and they just won't stop talking? Oh my God, and you're in a Charlie Brown cartoon. Wah, 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 wah. And you're up and you're thinking about whatever you're thinking about on your list. And then they say your name and you snap back into phase. The brain can disconnect from the senses. Absolutely. This happens all the time. This is a survival feature built into the very fabric of human consciousness. This is amazing. It's just not a good long-term strategy. It's a short-term strategy, right? And a lot of your people are living it as a long-term strategy that you're seeing. They're disassociating from their body and the pain's getting worse. Right? So this long-term strategy, the short-term strategy, the 13-year-old boy learns to do it. I learn as I'm surviving the onslaught of violence in acute care. Because don't kid yourself. The violence didn't end at the accident scene. It began. Okay? And I would not be here without it. Absolutely for sure. I'm grateful. But it was violence. And it was overwhelming for a 13-year-old boy. I mean, we broke my wrist, one without anesthesia. They threw the screws into my head. They did all sorts of things that they did to try to correctively offset the fact that they think the car bounced over my chest. Right? They had to do that. But I learned to go away from body. I learned to disassociate, if that's what you want to call it, and let my body survive the trauma and protect my mind somewhere else. So this, and we know kids that are sexually abused, sexual assault victims, we do this all the time. But quite frankly, so are you. You do stuff like this all the time, just not as extreme. And thank goodness that this is possible. But that's not a long-term strategy. So I want to just because I can tell some of you are beginning to wane already. Remember, I'm a yoga teacher, damn it. Sit up straight and tall. I'm serious. Sit up straight and tall. Right? Press down through your inner heels. So you feel more awareness in your legs when you do that? Now go behind the balance point. Lean back in your chair. So lean back. I call this channel flipper posture. Right? You ever notice you're more willing to look for the channel flipper for 10 minutes than get up and just change the channel? I have a 15-year-old son, and I go to him, dude, you know there was a time there weren't channel flippers? He's like, are you kidding me? Yeah, you'd have to get up and turn the channel. We've got a whole bunch of our culture getting us out of our bodies. Right? All right, so you're leaning back. Now sit up straight and tall again. Don't lean against the back of your chair. Press down through your inner heels. You feel your inner thighs now more? Can you feel that? If your feet are down flat, if you're actually participating, that'd be great, right? If you don't have that, I call the inner thighs the forgotten country. It's a lot of low back problems because the inner thighs are actually not engaging throughout your life. Right? And then lean back again and notice that there's a difference of sensation in your legs. I would call leaning back behind the gravity point less clear, less crisp. Sitting up straight and tall and making your sits bones more like knives. Right? Make them like knives, not like butter. Make them like knives. When you make them like knives, do you feel energy awareness go up your spine and down through your legs? Guess what? That transcends the severed spinal cord. That's why I'm a yoga teacher. That level of sensation, when I lean forward and I lean back, once I train myself to listen, I can feel changes in my human being based on changes of gravity, even though my central nervous system isn't intact, is ruptured. This is the part of the mind-body relationship that I want you to start figuring out how to share more directly with people, right? So that the silence, the part of the mind-body relationship, is that still working? So this idea, all I mean by mind-body connection is the difference between when you sit back in your chair and coming forward, the difference of experience in your legs, in your body, I just think is the mind-body connection, right? Where my mind experiences my body as a phenomena is the mind-body connection. And I'm telling you, we're not rehabilitating it well enough. We're not paying attention to the quality of my experience as I live in my body. You're not helping me think about that either. It's gotten, we're going too simple about, are you in pain, are you not in pain? Some pain isn't bad. In fact, if you can show a patient how pain comes to guide you, and it's not something to avoid, you engage me on a completely different level.
not just to sensate, to get to my pain to end, but to actually start to show me that it's revealing stuff, that I need a different relationship to pain if I have a chronic condition. But, and people think this is a psychological issue, it is not. It's a mind-body issue. So what I mean by silence, I'm just going to read a one little section about the mind-body relationship. So we define what I mean by mind-body connection, and that I think it's not being rehabilitated as much as it could be. So what I mean by silence, which is like the softer, kind of weirder part of this, and for some of you scientists, it's like, oh dear, right? But you, most of you here know what I'm talking about. So when I wrote this paragraph I'm about to read, I wrote it over 100 times, and I think it still sucks, actually. Whatever. But just know I'm trying to put a word to something you already experience. The silence is the word I use to describe the empty presence we experience within our experience. Between our thoughts, between each other, between ourselves and the world, we feel the silence when we daydream, when we appreciate the beauty of a sunset, or when the love of our life truly walks away. It is an inward sense, often experienced as a longing or an ache. It is a feeling of emptiness and fullness at the same time. The silence is the aspect of our consciousness that makes us feel slightly heavy. It is the source of the feeling of loss, but also of a sense of awe. You guys, do you get it on Sunday nights before Monday starts? You know, that kind of existential angst you have, like, oh my God, how is it starting again? Right? You know what I'm talking about. You really, and then maybe it's Sunday night and there's still a load of dishes to do. Or there's something that has to get done and you're pissed off, you really want to go to bed. And you're thinking, why am I the one that has to do this? How come it's always freaking me? And yet, you wash the dishes anyway and you let the warm water runs over your hands and you let time slow down and you stay with it. What part of you do you think answers the Monday morning alarm? What do you think is the sense of your true strength and resilience? Is it this? Is it your brawn? Is that what answers the bell? No. Is it your brawn or your strength that makes you show up with me as your patient? No. It's in a different part of your mind-body relationship. And it's not just your attitude, although attitude helps. How do you support the silence in another human being? The vulnerability in another human being? How do you help transform vulnerability into strength? Because if you can't transform your own vulnerability into strength, how can you ever really show me anything? Really. The issues here, you know, because disability, for example, and this is just more extreme, it's an unrelenting mistress. I don't learn my disability while I'm with you. I learn it when I fall at 2 a.m. on the floor in the dark. That's when I know I'm disabled. What answers that bell? Please don't tell me it's just a good attitude. Please don't tell me it's just my upper arms. Please be more honest with me. Please don't be afraid of what I am. Share with me in my experience without losing your boundary. I'm seeing a failure of boundaries for healthcare professionals. They're not knowing how to sit with my suffering and not have to withdraw. They're not knowing how to be connected without trying to fix me. How to share in what precedes my condition, even for 10 seconds in a 15-minute encounter. Are you sitting with me before you start fixing me. Not out of respect. Not asking me how the weather is. Not complimenting my shoes. Sitting with me for a second. Do you think it'll transform our relationship? It absolutely will. If you do that, do you think you'll get a deeper part of me to be invested in what you're showing me? Absolutely it will. It's not bedside manner. It's energetic common sense. Right? But so much of our medical model is not doing this. And you know how they're telling you to do it? Be more patient-centered. Freaking insane. You're getting told something insane. But if you haven't noticed, there's a lot of insanity out there. All right. So I want to go forward with my story a little bit. So I live a mind-body problem, right? That's what I actually live. I actually, if you tickle the bottoms of my feet, I don't feel it. If I tickle the bottoms of your feet, you feel it. I'm different than you, right? And the doctors, there's a real crucial scene in Waking where it's about 2 months after I'm just out of intensive care after 2 months. And I'm laying there and I'm being told over and over I have no sensation below my point of injury. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute, I think I do. I think I do feel stuff. And as soon as I report that, they're worried. Because they conceptualize my injury only on two axes. They see it as a physical injury with psychological and emotional implications, right? That's the two axes. And they know my spinal cord is severed. It's devastated. They can't fix it. They feel inadequate. And they're sad about that because they're good people. So as soon as I start to report sensation, they think, uh-oh, he's not going to accept that he's never going to walk again. So they deliver a crucial story to me. After I'm saying, hey, I can kind of feel something. It's not normal. It's kind of a tingling or a hum. It's kind of weird. I'm a 13-year-old boy. I don't have language. I'm not a 49-year-old man with language now. Right? And so they go, well, you know, those aren't real. Really? No, it's like you're like an amputee. An amputee thinks they have two legs, they don't, until they look under the covers. That sensation is mental memory, it'll fade. It's really hard to be told that what you're experiencing isn't real. But we do it to kids all the time. Right? It's too bad. So I think I'm trained as an academic philosopher, you guys. So I think this started my academic career right here. I start to argue. I go, wait a minute. I can feel them even when I'm not thinking about it. Can you explain that? Huh? And so they step back. I go, okay, do you want to talk to a couple of neurologists? I said, sure. Yeah, damn right I do. So I'm like trying to advocate for my reality. That sounds funny, right? I'm trying to advocate for my reality. They come in, and these two neurologist residents come in with one of them's carrying a black leather case. And he unzips the black leather case and falls open, and there's spikes and hammers and rollers with spikes on it. And I'm going, oh my God, what have I done? Why did I say anything at all? I'm tired of pain, actually, so I'm thinking I really screwed up. So they take the roller and they roll it over my arm, and they say, do you feel that? And I say, yep. And then they take the roller and they roll it over my foot, and they say, do you feel that? Nope. Beginning to get embarrassed. I'm laying there. And then they poke me in the finger with the pin, and they say, do you feel that? I say, yep. And they poke me in the foot and the toe, and they say, do you feel that? Now I'm ashamed. Now I'm thinking I shouldn't have said anything. I'm humiliated. And so I say, no. And then they complete their trifecta, and they say, I'm sorry. Those sensations aren't real. They make me an object of pity. in this pivotal moment of my recovery, I abandon feeling sensation below my point of injury. And what they've actually done is presented a very bad metaphysical argument. On the basis of something being different, you can't conclude something isn't real. That's a fallacy. Right? On top of it, they used a measuring stick, a physical input, to try to measure the reality of a sensation, said it, and then I didn't have the physical reaction, and then they did the conclusion that's fallacious to say then the sensation's not real. So it's like if you have a red ball and a blue ball, and you hold up the red ball to the blue ball and correctly assert that the blue ball isn't red, or the red ball isn't blue, right? The blue ball isn't red. And you go, yeah, that's right. And then on the basis of that may draw a conclusion that the ball's, that it's not a ball. That's what they did. And then they went a step further and went, it's not only is it not a ball, that ball doesn't even exist. You know, a 13-year-old boy can be ready for a lot of things, but a bad metaphysical argument from the adults in charge? What kid's ready for that? Except I put forward to you that our culture, even you, have been presented with the same argument. We don't value the subtle parts of our mind-body relationship enough. We associate with weakness and vulnerability. We think it's psychological and too much emotional. Except it's actually a phenomena that occurs within the mind-body relationship. And I can tell you as I sit here in front of you that it's how I can feel my feet. It's how I can feel with the severed spinal cord when my bladder's full, my bowel needs emptying. It's how I can tell when I'm in pain. It's a sensation that lives in the mind-body relationship. Although it's never going to make me walk again. Right? It's not going to miraculously transform structure. Okay. But I got to figure out how to show up all of me in the rest of my recovery. That's what I need as I'm traveling through your space. I've got to figure out how I'm going to live outside of being with you. I need all of me. I need my brawn. I need all of me. That's part of what is the long-term recovery. Of course, I encounter a rehabilitation model. On top of being told that sensation isn't real, I encounter a rehabilitation model that guides me to compensate for the loss. Makes sense. Can't feel below that point. Make your upper body really strong. Learn to drag your paralyzed body through life. That's a vision, a healing vision. Play some wheelchair basketball, maybe some downhill skiing. Your life's good. Really? I miss my body. Really? Is there no way for it to be present in my whole body? I'm so glad there are osteopaths. I'm glad there are actually people that are willing to explore sensation. Figure out not just the physics of it, but what it means when people are in contact with each other. How you can show me things about how to be awake and alive in my whole body and not just feel pain. Not have the only reference to my body be through pain. Because that's what happens to people with chronic pain, right? They're afraid of their body because they only connect through the pain to their body. As opposed to someone showing me how to have not pain in my body. These are all sorts of things that are really good. So I encountered this rehabilitation model, and it tells me to overcome. I do this for 12 years when I slowly become a floating upper torso. I miss my body. So I had to do something. I was an athletic kid. So I started to try to do yoga. Started to figure out, wait a minute, I'm going to start paying attention. I'm actually going to listen to my own experience. Not what it's like to be a paralyzed person in this culture, but what does the experience of paralysis actually feel like as a sensation in my mind-body relationship? So just so if you think this level of sensation I'm talking about isn't real, just so you know, and when I was at that Rochester symposium at the Mayo Clinic, I didn't say this until a little bit in, but they put my head in a functional MRI at the University of Rutgers about 6 years ago, and they grabbed my ankles, and my sensory cortex, they didn't show me they grabbed my ankles. My sensory cortex lights exactly map to my ankles. It jumps over to my motor cortex, so it's not just sensual. It jumps over and improves my coordination. So once I said that to the room of the doctors at Mayo Clinic, they started to sit up. Ironic that it takes a magnetic resonance image for them to believe something's real. What happened? What happened? Their training made them lose connection to the report from me, our dynamic. They needed another type of indirect evidence that something was happening, right? So this level of sensation that I'm like giving you a qualitative story about silence and feeling stuff in the mind-body relationship and all this talk that some of you judge maybe to be too fluffy for you, too soft for you, right? Well, some of you haven't, and I'm telling you, I don't know what other words there are. I don't know how to describe what I'm experiencing to you. So I wrote a story. So I'm telling you a story so you can start listening. So you don't have to have your paradigm threatened directly. I believe in story. I believe in coming into roomfuls of people and telling stories so they can like start to wonder on in their own case what they're going to do, how they're going to do it. So this level, you know, I can feel on the inside of my process. I know how to teach it. I've been teaching people with all levels of ability and disability for 17 years. I've been training healthcare professionals for about the last 8, because I figured out that the only way that you guys can teach it to someone that lives with a disability is to feel it yourself, to actually let it be. So how many of you, no, I don't raise your hand because I don't want you to have to like come out of the closet. How many of you actually took off your shoes? How many of you didn't? Why not? Why aren't you actually being the change in the world you want to see? Why aren't you just showing up a little bit more? And realize you can show up a little bit more and not lose your boundary. That in fact, part of what's gone wrong in our system is that you're not being allowed to show up as a human being. And you would. I don't want to know your personal story. You can learn to show up with me without having to tell me your personal facts. Seriously, it's okay. I don't need to know what you had for breakfast. But it would be great if healing was more of a partnership, right, where you included me a little bit more in the sensations of what are going on. I don't need to know all the anatomical stuff that you guys need to know. You need to help me feel things I'm not used to feeling, though. You have to help me go inward to find the part of the mind-body relationship that's going to help me over time. Right? That's the part we need. And so how do you do that? Well, I think it's actually pretty simple. And at the same time, how do we help the fact that you guys are giving too much of yourself away? You figure out how to share better. So I want to end or do a thing, quick little thing. It's a big group, but will you come up and be my partner? Yeah. So some of the stuff I'm going to do in my breakout session is like there are a couple sensations I'd like you guys to study as, come on up, as healthcare professionals. Do you guys study the sensation of support? Do you know what it feels like in the mind-body relationship? How about the sensation of grounding? Do you study it? Do you know how to create it in yourself and others? As a mind-body sensation, so she's one of the ones that didn't take off her shoes. She's fired. All right, her feet were cold, so she's going to turn this way. Turn face that way. Take up your shoes, right? Okay, so right away I'm asking her to give up her back to me. Very hard to do. In front of 600 people, really hard to do, right? Do you know more nourishment comes in through the back body of the mind-body relationship than the front? Nourishment comes in better when it's less mediated by mental judgment, right? Except she has to be okay with me being behind her and trust that I'm not making faces. Caregivers suck at giving up their back body. You guys suck at receiving, most of you. You don't, and that you're asking me to receive all day long. right? So what I just want us to do with this ending exercise is to support the upper thoracic of somebody else, right? And I'm going to say to you, in my language, do you know how to support the silence of another human being? The subtle part of who they are. Do you think you do that better in words or with touch? I'm telling you, it's not words. I think you already know it's not words, right? So I'm just going to put my hand between her shoulder blades. She's doing as much yoga as I'm doing, right? She's got to receive and let in the support in the upper thoracic. Reconfigure. There you go. Take your head back a little bit. Reconfigure. There, you feel that change? Right? Reconfigure around the support. You know what's crazy, you guys? As she receives this support, the inside of my paralysis hums louder. I've got the canary in the coal mine for contact. That's exactly the place I was told that I couldn't feel. Right? So as she lets in and I listen with my hands, we come into equilibrium and the subtle bodies start interacting better. Right? Now notice it's really important when you share, that feels good, right? You feel the lightness in the lights. Notice it's really important not to come around to the front of her and say, hey, didn't that feel good? Once I make it personal, I've got boundary problems, right? Especially when you're creating relief in another human being. But check out how important this is. If I'm afraid of her body, do you think we're as connected? Right? All the things you need in our connection aren't going to be as good. If I push on her a little bit too hard, if I violate her conditions of safety, don't let me push you over, but I'm going to push her, just to lock her neck, we're not connected. Come back and lean on me some, a little harder. I hold her up, if she can, a little harder. If I have to sturdy up here, we're not connected. Not in the way we could be, right? So it turns out that my position is crucial for this dynamic. My ability to give and receive will maximize what she experiences. It's so subtle that if I even sit too directly behind her and cross the midline with my shoulder, our experience isn't as good because too much tension's in my shoulder. Right? I'm not connected down to the ground. So the idea that we're trying to figure out how to share and interact. There she goes again. See, it feels really good. As caregivers, why aren't you connecting like this? Not like this in particular. At this level before you start manipulating. Bad word, by the way, you guys. All right? So I want you to stand up, partner up, and I'd rather be with somebody you don't know. And I'd like you to support, I'm going to go just a couple minutes long, right? I want you to support the back of someone's upper thoracic. Thanks. Now notice you're going to have all this awkward energy. You're going to be like, oh no, I don't know this person. You're going to have to talk because you're uncomfortable. Some of you are going to be a tall drink of water with a short drink of water. So some of you are going to have to kneel because you're trying to figure out, so this tall drink of water is going to have to kneel with the shorter drink of water because you've got to get in the position where you can hear the subtle body, right? So, and if the guy's wearing a thick jacket, that's going to suck, right? All right. But and you got a tall drink of water, kneel down over there. I'm looking at you, a guy in the beard with the woman in the pinch shirt. You should kneel down, right? Figure out how to go slightly in and gently up and help there be space in their upper thoracic. Help them feel that relief in the upper thoracic. Notice that it changes so as the person receives, the person giving should start to feel when they start to open. I want to say this is supporting the silence of another human being. I want to say that most trauma lands in the flesh, but in this space, in the mind-body relationship. PTSD lands here. Whole bunch of places land experientially into my body through this space. Do you know how to support it in another human being? More importantly, do you know how to receive support at this level? Right? And then slowly release your hand. You miss your buddy, don't you? You owe a karmic debt. Switch it up. Switch it up. Remember, now the second person should have an advantage, right? Because you felt the lightness. Imagine I'm coming through you and I'm afraid and I'm losing freedom. And can you show me freedom through your hands into my mind-body relationship before you start working with me and on me? Slightly in and up. And as the person receives better, it's going to feel better to you. The dynamic between you and me is the delivery system of your knowledge. There's this really dumb guy, he said, be the change you want to see in the world. So the person adjusting, feel the hand on the back of your sternum. Let it inform how you touch, how you open. The lightness in the mind-body relationship. And then slowly release. Have a seat back down. Give me back the room quick because I've got like 2 minutes. So put your lips together. Put your lips together. How about shut your hole? Right? Put your lips together. So part of what happened in my rehabilitation, to wrap it up, was that there wasn't a willingness to share the subtlety of what was happening. There wasn't anyone that was showing me not just how to compensate for my body that's now, quote, injured, but remember, only a little bit of my flesh didn't heal. This much of my spinal cord, the tenderest part, right? The tenderest part of the human being didn't quite make it back all the way. But nobody showed me how to live in my whole body again. Nobody, and, you know, I've got scoliosis and, you know, I need to get better connection to my feet. That's how my quality of life is going to get better. Maybe if you straighten my back out, that'll help that. It will, actually. In fact, I wish a lot of you would touch me more, right? Yeah, a lot of you have really good hands. But it's like, how do you help someone feel whole? Do you know how not connected I feel when the doctor never touches me? When someone sold healthcare a bunch of goods, thinking that information is more important than human contact. So it's all going into a computer rather than in the dynamic. Right? Oh my God, someone got sold a whole bunch of goods, man. Right? And you guys are actually now being able to see less patients rather than more. You know, so it's actually done exactly the opposite. But the idea that your art is controlled by information and knowledge. It's not. It's a journey that you and I share. That's what healing is. But can you come out from behind the veil of your training, master your training, and be with me? And be in dynamic with me. And actually, I think the way for you to do that is to take longer showers. I think you guys should lay spread-eagled on the floor more. I think you should start feeling sunlight on your skin more. I think you should start learning to be more sensual without being sexual. I think that you should live through the very pores of your skin so you can come into me and live through the pores of your skin in front of me, and I non-verbally realize what it means to ground, what it means to be okay even though things suck. Right? That's a huge part of the learning. So the closing image I want to, about the body, because I spent years thinking I had to overcome my body, and I'll talk about that more in a while. But when my son's 15 now, but when he was 4, he was naked from the waist down, and he was trying to watch Sesame Street, and he couldn't quite watch Sesame Street because he was too active. So he hung upside down off the couch in headstand, off the couch, trying to stay focused, and he's waving in the breeze, right? And in that moment, I thought, oh my God, he's figured it out. He's figured it out. So my parting words is, you don't need to hang upside down naked. But my outcome needs you to feel more. That's the key. All right, thanks, you guys.